Welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Valdana Hyrick, a cross-asset reporter at Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, as any listeners who stick around long enough for our craziest things in market segments know, we're kind of fascinated with NFTs these days. You know, the non-fungible tokens that are some of the hottest investments in the cryptocurrency markets these days. We're going to take a deep dive into NFTs and all sorts of other hot topics on the blockchain this week with the CEO of a company that's involved in cryptocurrency investing. Now, you know, Valdana, I don't know if you've noticed that I'm not necessarily the youngest, hippest guy in the world. Have you picked up on that?
Yeah, I think everybody has.
I'm sorry to break it to you. The cat's out of the bag. So one of the hazards of being not so young and not so hip is that you tend not to like new things. You know, you're like, well, what's wrong with these old things? I like the old things. And that was.
Yeah. Do you still have an iPhone 2?
I actually have a 12. I've upgraded to the 12 recently, but only because.
Oh, you're hipper than me.
Only because my old iPhone 1 or whatever it was, that it just stopped working. So I am hip on the iPhones. But I'll tell you what, when you're a not so young and not so hip guy, you tend to have a lot of friends who are not so young and not so hip. And I've been fascinating. Any party I go to lately, the subject of NFTs come up and people get like irrationally angry at them. Like, why are these things worth anything? They're just JPEGs, you know? And I find myself being the voice of reason trying to explain, well, you know, look at a Babe Ruth baseball card. What's the intrinsic value of the cardboard that's printed on? You know, it's all the scarcity value, the originality value of the item. Anyway, that's my way of explaining it. But we do have a guest this week who I think will do a better job than me in explaining.
Hopefully.
Yeah. You can only go up from here, right?
Right. Yeah.
So I think he'll give us sort of the bull case, at least on some segments of the NFT market. So we're happy to have him on the show for the first time. He is the CEO of Ether Capital Corp. That's a publicly listed company on Toronto's NEO exchange. His name is Brian Mossoff. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, and hope to join in on correcting some of the way you look at NFTs as an old person who gets angry. Sorry, yes. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but hopefully you're not angry by NFTs. And yeah, let's dive into why they may be potentially very valuable.
I am an old person who gets angry very easily. It's true. That's absolutely right. But I'm coming around to these newfangled investments. But before we delve into that, I just want to sort of have you introduce us to Ether Capital, what the company's all about, how you got involved with it, what the sort of mission and revenue stream is of the company. You know, what's it all about?
So Ether Capital was put together in early 2018, and everyone looked around and said that during the bull run of 2017, crypto assets were going crazy. Bitcoin's going from a few thousand dollars up to $20,000. The ICO mania is going on. And it was really hard to find an access point in the capital markets to invest in the asset class and follow a group of people around the table who really understood the space. And so Ether Capital had a very focused thesis, the group of people, around Ethereum and what was going to happen, that there would be this smart contract platform that would be a very important piece of the internet. And so it was put together to be an access point in the capital markets to a group of investors who said, I don't quite understand the space, but there seems to be something happening there, and I want exposure to it. And it's funny because that's basically the same conversations that's happening around NFTs now, right? There's something happening there. There's a lot of hype, but it's hard to find where's the real meat on the bone. What is going to last 2 years, 5 years, 10 years that comes from all this mania? So Ether Capital invests in Ethereum-focused protocols, in tokens, in infrastructure. We're a group of crypto natives and traditional finance and venture capitalists who make up management and the board. And we're passionate about this stuff. We're passionate about the space. I've been in crypto since kind of late 2012, early 2013. This is my life. I don't have normal friends anymore. I don't have regular conversations. It's crypto 24/7 on Twitter, on Discord, various chat groups. So very excited to, you know, come here and shed some of what I'm seeing with your listeners.
It's funny. To me, it boils down to there's certain class of investors who are like, yeah, crypto, it's exciting. Just tell me what I need a stock to buy. I need a stock to buy. And that's kind of the niche you fill with a company like this to some degree, I guess.
I mean, I think it's great if you look at kind of where we're at in terms of exposure points in the capital markets. There's a number of different ways that now you can get proxies to crypto, whether it's through mining companies or ETFs or closed funds that are listed in the US, there's avenues for people to get exposure who aren't yet comfortable going and buying the asset direct and either custodying it themselves or holding it on a platform that's not registered as kind of their traditional securities dealer. So, you know, the space is improving. There's more access points now than ever. And, you know, that's great for everyone. That's great for the space. It's great for that new set of investors who weren't comfortable from 2009 up until kind of 2020, who might have said, I want exposure to this space. I just don't know how to do it. And so they sat on the sidelines because they had no other choice. So I think that it's all good for the space. But now we have this new part of the space, the NFT part, as you're saying, and people are wondering, well, how do I invest in that? Do I even want to invest in that? So
Brian, I'm hoping we get to NFTs in a little bit, but I know that you had sent us a list of some of the most frequently asked questions you get from people, especially retail investors. And one of them was, what are the real world problems crypto is trying to solve? And I feel like maybe that's something you guys were also thinking about before you started the firm. So what sort of answer do you give them when people ask you that?
It's kind of a two-pronged question, because I think most people are looking for an everyday use case that they can latch onto and say, ah, now I understand what this thing is going to be. And it's kind of hard to look at that right now because it's still very much in this experimental phase. So we know that one thing that crypto assets do is they create an investment opportunity or a network that is uncorrelated to traditional assets, or over time hopefully becomes uncorrelated to traditional assets. It's outside of the monetary policy of any political agenda, a specific jurisdiction. When I look at what Bitcoin did, Justin Drake, who's an Ethereum researcher, describes what Bitcoin did is it came along and said, gold has this really interesting monetary policy. It has a very few unique attributes to it. There's a fixed amount. It has to be extracted from the Earth's crust. It gets mined and extracted at a very specific rate. But the problem with gold, of course, is that it's physical and it's not digital. So it can only go so far. And in the world of digital assets and digital transforming of or sharing information, gold doesn't really work in that world. So Bitcoin comes along and says, can you replicate that same kind of monetary policy, but in a digital environment? But Bitcoin kind of stops there. And that's kind of what Bitcoin does. You can send it, you can receive it, but it can't do much more than that. Ethereum comes along and says, well, what if you kind of create this clearinghouse for the world? The first thing that Ethereum really does is say, what if the world has a clearinghouse that no one company, no one party controls, and anyone can record their activity, their information, their token, tokenize their dollar, whatever activity they want to perform can be recorded into this global ledger, this global settlement layer, and just pay a little transaction fee. So even though that's still kind of abstract, right? People are wondering, well, what do I do with that? Who cares? So what? I think we're still scratching the surface of how people are going to use this. And we're starting to see use cases emerge. You're starting to see decentralized finance come around. You're starting to see NFTs, digital art, right, that exists on a blockchain. That's becoming a recent trend. Visa, about 6 months ago, said that they're going to test tokenizing US dollars and moving them across the Ethereum network for settlement between their data centers. So there's all sorts of use cases that may seem legit, like what Visa does, that has a kind of nexus to the real world. But then there's this digitally native set of uses that we are not used to and are brand new. And the second prong to this, which is much shorter, I promise, I would say is that it's kind of like looking at the internet in the mid-90s and saying, well, okay, fine, I can only send an email if all my friends have an email account. How valuable is this thing going to be? The things that really became valuable were not just taking what existed in the physical world and saying, now I can replicate this in this digital environment. It was all these use cases that no one imagined yet. So the early internet, you know, had people taking their newspapers, their magazines, and just copying and pasting the content. And what really was valuable about the internet was saying, well, if something is digitally native and it's built from the ground up respecting kind of the protocol design and the flexibility that this new architecture allows, well, then all of a sudden, it's not just about putting your newspaper up on some web page. It can become interactive. in a way that the world had never seen before, right? Social media, Instagram, broadcasting, Twitter, these were things that didn't have an existing structure prior to the internet. And so I think people who are looking for the, how do I copy and paste an old model just into this environment? There will be some of that that goes on. And there's probably some, you know, 9 to 10 improvements in there, but it's the 0 to 1s. It's those brand new use cases that, you know, Peter Thiel talks about. That's what's really exciting here.
I want to rewind a little bit. I'm glad you brought up that notion of crypto being an uncorrelated asset. This is kind of a perennial debate here in crypto markets, because at least looking at the big ones, if you look at Ethereum and Bitcoin, there are sort of long stretches of time where they do appear to be uncorrelated to, say, the S&P 500. But then you have a week like this where you get kind of a macro shock with the China Evergrande or Evergrande situation. I don't think anyone knows which one is right. But you get this shock, this sort of risk off move in markets. And crypto does seem to sort of tighten up that correlation with everything else. And I imagine, you know, as more companies like yours come onto the public markets, as more companies like MicroStrategy and Tesla hold more crypto on their balance sheets, that there's the risk of that, those correlations tightening up even more. So is that sort of promise of crypto being uncorrelated, dying a slow death, or am I looking at it wrong? You know, how do you look at that concept?
I think that these assets over time will become more and more uncorrelated. Certainly, I think one of the things that you've seen in the last year or year and a half, you know, since COVID, is we've realized the world is more interconnected and all these markets are more interconnected than everyone even imagined. And it didn't matter if it was the OPEC crisis. It didn't matter if it was what just happened in the last week. People are looking for safe havens in these extreme moments of volatility. And the question is, where are the safe havens going to be? What is the safe haven these days? Is it the US dollar? Is it crypto? Is it, you know, where is that money going to go? And markets don't like uncertainty. I think that we've seen that, you know, before crypto, in crypto, people don't like uncertainty. So this notion that crypto is this uncorrelated asset, I think is something that will be more and more true as time goes on, as it continues to prove itself to be robust in volatile times. I think it was very important that in the March of 2020 market crash, Bitcoin and Ether and, you know, all the crypto markets, despite them having this 40 to 50% drop in basically a 24-hour period, which is extreme, by the way. I got a lot of texts. It was not a happy day, certainly, yeah, for my phone blowing up and with my friends. But, you know, what you did get to see is that the space didn't die. The asset class did not go to zero. And in fact, not only did it not go to zero, it woke up this new group of investors who had written off this idea of Bitcoin or Ethereum or crypto assets and said, there's this pending inflation that everyone's concerned about. What are the alternatives? I mean, so there's gold, fine, but maybe some of that spills off into Bitcoin. And so you have these new investors who before did not want to participate in this environment and say, maybe crypto is a place that has a part in a portfolio. Doesn't matter if it's big or small, but maybe this is going to become a legit asset class. So I think that it's still going to be volatile for the foreseeable future. It's still going to be correlated in times like this. And over time, that volatility will drop and people will be less scared and the swings will be less wild. So it's there. It's going to take time, though.
When we talked about a week ago, I was impressed with sort of your bull case for NFTs. And CryptoPunks, or as I call them, cyberpunks, as I incorrectly call them, cyberpunks, but CryptoPunks, I was impressed with sort of your rationale for why we should take these seriously. So, you know, give me some more ammunition at my cocktail parties with the angry old men that I associate with when they say, it's just a JPEG, it's not worth anything. What's your bull case here for this whole asset class?
So I think it's helpful for listeners to understand the mechanics behind this specific project as we dive in and then discuss how they're going to be used in these new systems, because then there's just more context there. So in 2017, Larva Labs basically publishes 10,000 unique characters that have various combinations of attributes as JPEGs, Actually, I think that they're technically either SVG files or PNGs. I'm not sure, but someone super techie out there is going to jump on me if I call it a JPEG. But they publish it, and whether it's a male CryptoPunk or it's female, or it has wild white hair or 3D glasses or maybe a handlebar mustache, there's all these different attributes and different combinations of these attributes. And they put it up on this website, and they're completely free. All you had to do is pay the $4 gas fee, and you could claim one to your address. You would claim the ownership over that picture. And most people wrote this off and said, well, that's kind of an interesting idea, but I'm not interested in paying the $4 for this JPEG. Forget it. And what ends up happening is there's enough people go, this is kind of an interesting idea. How would you create a token that represents a specific thing versus something that's fungible? So for anyone who's not familiar, right, fungibility would just be, I give you the $5 bill. You don't care which $5 bill I pull out of my pocket. You're happy that I give you a $5 bill. In a non-fungible token world, the token represents a specific thing. So it's not just that you bought a house on this street. You care which house specifically you purchased. And so in the context of the CryptoPunks, you don't care that you have a claim on a CryptoPunk. You want to know that, no, I bought the specific CryptoPunk with the handlebar mustache and the 3D glasses. And it spawns a bunch of research and a new token standard on Ethereum. So it's a different tech standard, basically. And that's called a ERC 721. It goes away, and it possibly just goes away because we're in this bear market, right? This is kind of mid-2017, 2018, the price of crypto crashes. And so most people are kind of shying away from the space. Maybe some developers leave. The community shrinks a little bit. But NFTs are certainly not what they are today. And in the, I would say, mid-2020s, and people are waking up to this idea of digitally native art, you know, that lives on a blockchain, and how could it be sold for this much? And around this point in time, everyone turns in the community back towards the CryptoPunks and says, well, this is the first, right? This is the first time anyone ever tried this experiment on Ethereum. It spawned the ERC-721 token standard. There's only 10,000. There can't ever be more of them. People turn around and say, well, CryptoPunks are the first. And in an environment where everyone is looking for scarcity, right? As the US dollar is hitting this, you know, pending inflation, people are looking at gold. A lot of the criticisms that people have towards NFTs, in a way, you can catch them and say, how is that any different than your arguments towards Bitcoin? And then they'll go, no, but Bitcoin's different. And you go, why? And you start hearing them say, well, there's a fixed amount of them. You go, yeah, but you could create other Bitcoins, right? You could create Litecoin. You could create Dogecoin. You could have Feathercoin. There's something sticky about being the first and representing a specific point in time culturally that a community rallies around in terms of consensus, that they say, this is the one. And so I also like to point out to people who say that there's no intrinsic value, or there's you know, how are they valued? Look at something like Twitter. Twitter is not valuable because of the number of servers that they're running and the number of data centers that they have and the backups. No, it's valuable because you can't just replicate that same number of servers and data centers somewhere. It's valuable because there's social consensus and a network effect that has taken place around that set of standards that people go, we're all going to rally around this thing. And we think that that's the place to have our, you know, three sentence communication. And that's where the value comes. It's the network effect. And that applies to Bitcoin. And that also applies to CryptoPunks. So the CryptoPunks start getting bought up kind of in that latter half of 2020, and then have this huge explosion basically, you know, throughout this year. And the reason that they're valuable is they're the first. They're the very first NFT project that exists in Ethereum. They're kind of, in a way, the birth of this entire movement. So the people who criticize and say all of NFTs are a bubble and they're not worth anything, I will agree that most NFTs probably won't be around in 5 years or hold any value 5 years from now. But CryptoPunks specifically, those are the opportunities to buy these works of art that some people would argue it isn't art, but it's the opportunity to buy into these very early historical pieces that have not only cultural significance, but they also represent, I think, a transition in the art world towards more utility to what these pieces of art can do.
So I was thinking of this column that Matt Levine at Bloomberg Opinion wrote a couple days ago, where he quoted somebody who said, you know, this NFT that this person had bought brought this person joy. And so it got me thinking about, like, what are some of the reasons somebody might want to own an NFT besides just the collectibles aspect of it? And, you know, it's not like if you buy a share of Ford, for instance, that sort of brings you joy or joy or makes you happy. But like, what are some of the other reasons that somebody might be into NFTs besides just the collectible aspect?
So I think that most of the purchasing of NFTs right now is on speculation. People are trying to catch the next Pudgy Penguin or Bored Ape Yacht Club that will have this huge explosion in price and value. And there's something fun about it. It doesn't take itself too seriously. In fact, kind of the weirder and the more fun these NFTs can be by design, the more people seem to be interested in playing with them. But there's something else happening under the surface, which is that utility. And I think that's where I sit in my interest in what NFTs are going to be. And there's two things here. The first is, I think what you're seeing in the world also right now is that, a controversial statement, but I'll just say it, is money is just a meme, right? All money in a way is just a meme. I call money memes, right? The US dollar, what is the meme of the US dollar? Well, it's most powerful nation in the world, most successful economy in the world, biggest army, most stability, you know, it represents certain things. And so if you think about this as an equation, I was saying this to a friend the other day, that if you think that this is an equation where you have money on one side, an equal sign, and then a meme word on the other side, what we're starting to see is that the equation goes in two directions, and that memes can also become money. And that's something that I don't think people had considered before, is that something can meme its way into being money. And you watch that kind of starting to happen with Dogecoin. Dogecoin came out in, I think, late 2013, the last week or two, the code gets published. People get really excited by it. It's fun. It's not taking itself too seriously. And then it kind of goes away. And now there's this renewed interest in 2020 where people are going, maybe this is going to be a transactional currency. I don't know, why not? There's so much of it. People seem to love it. It doesn't have the political agenda of any specific nation or group of people. It's kind of like the people's money, right? It's just fun. Now, it doesn't mean that it'll be money today, but it wouldn't surprise me if Dogecoin became the way people paid to go see a movie or I don't know, paid to buy their groceries with it. And so I think the idea that money has kind of turned into a meme and memes can now turn into money unlocks this really interesting potential for NFTs. Michael, when I was speaking to you, I think a week ago, and I was telling you about all this utility that NFTs can potentially have, one of the reasons people might be buying NFTs is because they're starting to understand the potential utility of some of these assets. So CryptoPunks in particular, you know, if there's enough price discovery on these assets, and there's high enough velocity, and it has, you know, the Lindy effect, it's around long enough, potentially what happens is some new utility gets unlocked. And so we have to go beyond just looking at them as forms of art and say, well, what is the Venn diagram then of this going to be? And that is that it unlocks things that don't really exist in the art world. So complete global access and liquidity is a new part of this equation. Right? Someone who lives in Asia, someone who lives in South America can now participate in the financial aspect, or you could sell it to someone who lives in that part of the world. There's also crypto economics that enters into the equation. There's also the programmability and the decentralized finance aspect of these assets. And so there's all these kind of really interesting ways that NFTs, I think, are going to be used in the future that go beyond just you bought a picture.
But Brian, before we get to the crazy things, I do want to touch on that idea you're talking about of DeFi and how NFTs kind of can get some added utility to them. You know, there was some project, was it an ape or a gorilla that spits off a banana every day. That's as a separate NFT. That's you know, I think of it as like a dividend. But my point is that
is this actually a project? Did I miss this one?
An ape? It is. I'll send you a link to it. Yeah, I forget the name of it.
So people want to buy the bananas,
and then people buy the bananas. Yeah, the bananas. I don't know. But because the reason I bring it up is every day we wake up to some new headline, news headline about regulators finally catching up with this whole industry And, you know,
incorrect. There is no catching up. It moves way too fast. But sorry to interrupt. Keep going.
No, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. And I agree. I totally agree with you. But I would always kind of thought of NFTs as vaguely regulator proof, because I don't see an argument about how an NFT could be a security unless you start using it in yield farming and that sort of thing. And then maybe that crosses the line. But for the broad picture, you know, how are you thinking about the regulatory risks in the entire space, you know, and sort of how do you determine who the winners and losers are going to be as the regulation scrutiny gets a little bit greater? And, you know, and if NFTs fit into your thinking of that at all, then so be it. But I'm just curious, you know, when you wake up and see a new headline about this regulator, that regulator, you know, issuing a subpoena or sending a Wells notice or whatever it is, how do you decide who's going to win and lose in an environment where the scrutiny is getting ratcheted up?
I don't think it matters that much what regulators do. I think what it does do is it'll change how people interact with these assets and how they interact from specific jurisdictions. But I don't think the assets themselves are going to just disappear overnight. You can't regulate at the protocol level, meaning you can't change the code of Bitcoin. You can't force IP addresses into transactions. Now, you can do other things to try and extract IP addresses from transactions to look for nefarious activity. You saw this happen with, you know, the Silk Road case in 2014, I think, is when that was really going on. But what's going to get regulated here are the access points and the marketplaces. And that's fine, and it'll play out. However, I'm not against those being regulated. I think you're right in that NFTs are probably fairly regulator proof, but it depends on the distribution mechanism of the NFT, as you're saying. It kind of depends how the NFT gets used. So maybe the CryptoPunk specifically itself is not a security, but if you try and fractionalize it, you know, maybe then you've created a derivative, and maybe derivatives get caught up because it's held in a specific way and it gets trapped by securities law, or the marketplace that's trading those derivatives, you know, would have to register as some type of marketplace. I don't know exactly how this is going to play out. I think overall, it'll be good for the space and it'll be great for investors long term, because there'll be clarity around how to interact with these assets and these marketplaces. I think this is a personal thesis, not a ETH cap anything. I think what you're going to see is a bit of a bifurcation in the space where we're going to have these regulated versions of these assets, that there's KYC and AML applied to both sides of a transaction, or the wallets are fully KYC'd, where, you know, if you withdraw from Coinbase or any exchange, you know, they're going to have to know potentially who owns the wallet that the asset is withdrawn to. And that will only be able to interact with, you know, a certain other set of wallets potentially. But then I also see a whole other side of the world that is going to continue building these protocols and these assets in a way that may not be respectful of any specific jurisdiction's mandates. And so there may be trading that takes place in very unregulated environments, right? You can look at something like Uniswap or SushiSwap. These are decentralized exchanges, for anyone who's not familiar, where you don't KYC when you go there. You don't deposit your funds in any custodial wallet that's being housed by a corporation. And people who wrote off that idea that decentralization can get to scale or a meaningful amount of traction, one stat that I like to point out is that in early 2019, I think it was early 2019, whenever Uniswap kind of began, there was maybe $1 million a day sloshing around on Uniswap. So not a meaningful amount of volume. But in the summer of 2020, last year, there was about $3 billion a day, I think, that was traded on Uniswap. And that's not insignificant. And at the same day, whenever I don't know, looked at the stat or it made its way around Twitter, Coinbase also traded about $3 billion on the retail exchange. And so I looked at that and thought, that is fantastic and wild and crazy to imagine that this decentralized protocol that basically has zero employees, zero regulatory oversight, zero registrations, compliance, jurisdictions, offices, overheads, bank accounts, corporate registrations, was able to do the same volume as a company that has, you know, hundreds or thousands of employees. you have to imagine that that trend is not going to stop and that these protocols will become more robust. So the question really will become long-term, how does the regulated world interact with the decentralized world? If everything gets tried to be completely KYC'd and pushed back into boxes that regulators are comfortable with, my view is that we've just kind of recreated CeFi, centralized finance, with a little bit of optimization in there. The real interesting stuff is happening in that decentralized, chaotic world that, yeah, there's going to be a lot of scams and there's going to be a lot of things that go wrong, but I think that there's going to be a lot of really interesting things that come of it. And so it'll be interesting to see how this plays out and how people who live in heavily regulated jurisdictions will continue to get access to projects and protocols and marketplaces that have liquidity, that have important or meaningful assets that are going to play a big part of this future economy.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Well, Donna, KYC, you know what that means? That means know your customer. And if I know the customers of this podcast, I think one thing I know is they're ready for some crazy things that we saw in markets this week. How's that for a segue? Not bad, huh?
What a transition.
All right, thank you.
Really,
thank you.
Maybe your best ever.
I get to say, he emailed me ahead of time and said, just FYI, this is going to happen. So try and think of a crazy thing you saw in a market. And I thought, oh, I have something that will top anything else you guys have seen. And I'm curious, when I drop mine, I'm curious.
We should probably save his
for last. If you say a guest has ever topped this. I'll go last, though.
All right. Well, if Brian goes last, with that setup, you got to go last. So I'll go first. Mine's real simple. I'm taking us back to traditional TradFi markets with the return to the office of all the Wall Street banks and the money center banks in London, all the trading desks returning. I believe it was Citigroup in London, Vildana. They're offering therapy puppies upon arrival to work. You'll have a puppy to play with to sort of ease the stress of coming back to the office, which I find kind of adorable and kind of bizarre. But I will say my dog does not relieve stress. My dog creates stress, especially during podcasts and radio interviews and TV. You never know when he's going to start yapping. So I don't know.
I think I heard him earlier.
You already heard him. Yeah.
Someone wants a cat.
I know.
That's a good question.
What about the cat people of the world?
I don't know. More stress. I don't know. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how the therapy puppies work out. I don't know if therapy cats would be such a good idea with the claws and the allergies. And I don't know. Maybe there could be therapy NFT pudgy penguins or something like that. I don't know.
Not a bad idea. My cat is up for therapy cat petting. She's really great. My craziest thing also is in the traditional finance world. I want to give a shout out to Katie Greifeld, who actually flagged this one for me. And she had flagged an ETF filing earlier in the week from BlackRock. And BlackRock filed for a China tech ETF, which with everything happening with China and the sell-off there and the regulatory crackdown, the timing is so interesting to me. Yeah. So to me, this was one of the weirdest things that I mean, obviously there was a lot of weird stuff, but
It is an odd time.
I'm speechless on the timing.
All right. Good one. Good one. All right, Brian, you build it up for us here. Hit us with your craziest thing.
So it's an NFT story, since that's the topic of today's episode, basically. And that is an NFT project that started out with a website called JPEGs Automart. So J spelled J-A-Y space P-E-G-S. Automart, I mean, it's all, you know, pushed together for the URL, but it basically looks like a late 90s website, circa, you know, or a la GeoCities and Angel Fire, if anyone remembers those days with streamers and terrible colors and terrible fonts, which I actually think that the aesthetic is incredible. And they were selling NFTs of 2007 Kia Sedonas. And this began because someone found out that this is apparently one of the rarest cars in the world. It was not manufactured in any kind of high numbers. And so you could go on this website, and there was actually some very interesting kind of crypto economic distribution mechanisms that they used in this NFT drop. But everyone was very excited about getting a 2007 Kia Sedona NFT. And I look at this stuff and just go, this is amazing. This is just so much fun. And, you know, all my Discord and chat groups, this is everyone talking about getting their minivans. And have you made sure that you've got your keys yet and signed your lease paperwork? So I encourage everyone to go to that website and kind of see what it was all about. I'm not sure that it'll have staying power in the NFT world, but it definitely was the craziest and most fun thing I've seen this week in the crypto asset space.
That is pretty awesome. Kia Sedonas. I can't even picture what it's a minivan, I guess. You're right. They must be rare because I don't think I've ever just ridden in one. And I'll tell you, an old guy like me, I've ridden in a lot of minivans in my day, Vildana.
But here's a question. Was there really a difference between any minivan? Did the Dodge and the Chrysler, did any of them really look any different? It didn't matter. No one went over and said, oh, check out my Dodge one. It's like, no, it looks the same as all the other ones. Who cares? You're in a minivan. Let's be real. You're in a minivan. This is your life now. So,
but I think it ties back to your, and I've written about this too, but that whole notion of the entertainment value of an asset is something new and pretty fascinating, I think.
It's something new, and these things are very community driven, and this is a community made up by a bunch of programmers and researchers and tech misfits. And so the weirder and more funny something can be, those things become the flex. So In this world, you know, if you show up at, let's say, DevCon is a conference that takes place every year, minus the COVID year, the COVID years, whatever this is going to be. A flex is not going to be showing up at DevCon in a Porsche or a Ferrari. You know, the to the moon Lambo meme had its place in time, but that's not really what this is about now. If someone were to show up at the next DevCon in a 2007 Kia Sedona, I'm telling you, they will be the hero of that conference. At DevCon in Japan, someone brought the Shiba Inu dog, the Dogecoin dog. And I think it was either the actual dog that the picture and the meme was based on, or it was the brother or the sister. I can't remember. Yeah. Everyone lost their minds and had to walk out of the conference and get a picture with this dog. So there's something fun about the community and the culture that intersects with these assets that I think is really special to be a part of.
Talk about a therapy puppy. There you go. Well, we'll have to check the prices of the actual real world Kia Sedonas and see if it'd be hilarious if they start going up in value as well for the same reason.
Low 2000s. I've already checked. I thought about trying to buy one just as a joke, but I didn't.
That's hilarious. Well, listen, Brian, I could talk about this for hours, but I think we got to leave it at that for this week. But hopefully we can get you back someday and cover everything we've missed. Because there's, as you said, there's so much going on in this space that it makes your head spin trying to keep up with it. But Brian Mossoff, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on the show, and hope to be back soon with more Kia Sedona-like stories, plus the legit stuff that's happening in the space.
What goes up, we'll be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Vildana Heirich is at Vildana Heirich. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellet of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.